Namaste.
Namaste.
It's a room full of divine beings. All of us are emanations of the divine light and the oneness of the supreme love. But the ego plays hide and seek with that light and that love. And eventually it's lost more often than it's found. And so if we're going to get out of this game of lost and found, we have to do something that the Sufis call dhikr or zikr, which is remembrance of God. The Sufis aren't the only ones who talk about remembering God. This is a universal practice across the different wisdom traditions. But the Sufis have gone into this idea much deeper than many of the other traditions. And so this month we're beginning the study of the Sufi wisdom tradition. And so getting into this idea of zikr is a very important and deep subject for us. Because the whole question revolves around whether you are able to remember God. And how deeply. And what does that really mean, remember? When did you meet him in the first place? Right? Many people will say, how can I remember him? He's a stranger to me. But then the Sufis, who are Orthodox Muslims, you know, remember the Shahada. There is no God but God. God is the one real, the supreme real, and the only real. So there is nothing real but God. So how can you not remember God? If you're remembering anything that's real, you're remembering God. The problem is, the ego is not real. The ego is the forgetfulness of God. When we snap out of it, when we awaken from the trance of the ego, what we realize is that there is no I but God. What we thought of as an I that was falsely identified with a body and a mind and a personality is not who I am. But I am He. I am the One. I am Allah. But not I, the ego, not I that's identified with an organism. But when that is let go of, there's an awareness that the very capacity to remember means the capacity to remember. These are all members, to make present again the real that we have cut ourselves off from. And in that state, then, the infinite, the one divine presence that we have always been, manifests instantly. There is no need even to call, to invoke that being ultimately, because the one doing the invoking is not different from that ultimate one. But to get there, we have to go through layers and layers of distrust, because we've forgotten who we are. We must remember who we are as spirits, as emanations, as microcosms of the one macrocosm before we can return to that remembrance. So how do we do that? Well, the Sufis have developed a whole beautiful tradition of teaching stories. I don't know how many of you are familiar with their stories, but you know, many of the traditions have done that, and we've talked about many of the Zen teaching stories, and there are the Hasidic Jewish teaching stories of the Baal Shem Tov. They're very famous. And there are, of course, the teaching stories of India, very, very rich. But the Sufi stories have their own unique structure and beauty that I think is worth recognizing and understanding and exploring a little bit, because they pattern the same formations of the unconscious mind that represent the lostness of one's being, so that one can allow that lostness to be witnessed and thus dissolved, because we need to disidentify from it. And so the stories are often depicting kinds of lostnesses that reflect our own. And there are thousands of these stories, so I'll pick one at random. There's a disciple, although I'd call him a pseudo-disciple, of a great Sufi master. But this disciple doesn't know that he's a great Sufi master. In fact, he's extremely critical of his master in his mind. He doesn't say it out loud, but he's, in his mind, he always thinks, this master, he's not wise, his words aren't wise enough, and his demeanor isn't humble enough, and he's not ascetic enough, you know, and he's not saintly enough, and he's not blah, blah, blah. So he's very wishy-washy about whether he'll trust him and even go on this path. But the master says to him, okay, look, I want you to come with me on my teaching journey, and it will accelerate your progress. So the two of them set out on this journey, and the master is going to visit all the different villages and towns in this area of the Middle East. And they're trudging along, and one day they've walked all day through very, very rugged terrain, and it's nightfall already, they're tired, they're exhausted, there's no food, they haven't had water all day, and they're out in this desert alone. But in the distance they see a light, and they keep walking toward it, and it's a little village, and the light, there's only one light on in the smallest hut at the edge of the town that's obviously very, very poor. The people who live there, and they knock on the door, and this very poor old man comes out. Not even that old; he's a middle-aged man, but he comes out and very smiling. You could tell this is a very beautiful soul. Very sweetly invites them in, and he gives them all of his food. He doesn't have very much, but he gives it all to them, and he lets them sleep in the one bed. He sleeps on the floor. And it's the most wonderful generosity you could imagine. And the Sufi master thanks him in the morning. They get dressed to go. And as he leaves, the master turns to him, to the host, and says, blessings upon you and your house. And he turns to leave. And the disciple is thinking, what? You can't do that. And he stops to the master. He says, you got to give him something. Give him some money. This isn't enough. You can't just say blessings and leave. And he starts to criticize him and give a sermon to the master saying, we must give all that we can to those who help us, and we must be generous and do all that we can for people, and you're not doing enough. And the master says, okay, if you insist, we'll see what happens. And the Sufi master turns to the man and says, in your garden, below the apple tree, there's a buried treasure. Dig it up and you shall flourish. And then he turns and he walks and he goes off on his journey. Well, the disciple is, you know, very curious and doesn't know what to make of all this, but he has no choice. He goes on the journey. They wander around for a year visiting all of these different towns on his circuit, and one year to the day they happened to come back to the same village. But now everything is different, and this little hut they were looking for where the guy used to live, it's gone, and in its place there's this gigantic palace. And the guy is obviously very rich. They try to knock on the door, but nobody answers. And then there's these thugs from the private army of the guy who lives in the palace who kind of shoo them away. And they start talking to the townspeople. And the townspeople are all grumbling. They're angry. They're sad. They're mad. This guy has become a real oppressor. He's become a tyrant. And they get more information, and they find out he was manipulated by some advisors who took over his business, and they're controlling him, and they have created a tyranny in this town. And everybody is suffering and oppressed. And so the disciple turns to the master and said, you caused this. You let this oppression happen. And the master laughed at him. And he waved his fingers, his hand in front of the disciple's face, and then suddenly the palace disappeared, and the hut was back. And he shook himself, and he realized that a year hadn't gone by. It was the same moment. And there was the old guy waving at him goodbye. It was the same moment. And he didn't know what to make of it. And suddenly all of these emotions came up in his mind about this. And he wanted to demand an answer, but he turned back to the Sufi master, but he had disappeared. He wasn't to be found. And the disciple tried to run after him down the trail to find him again. And he never found him. And they say to this day, his spirit is still wandering, looking for the master. So you can make out of that story anything you want. But I think it represents very deeply the lostness that comes from the lack of trust and the inability to go beyond one's own egoic categories of what's good and bad and real and not real. And we must be willing to pierce the boundaries of our own matrix of thought to discover the truth. So tonight, let's go beyond whatever paradigms and matrices of thought that we have about what is real and discover the supreme real that's within us that cannot be understood, that is an eternal enigma, a mystery, the ultimate mystery, and yet the mystery that is always waiting for us to discover and to be found by, of peace, and of love, and of acceptance of the perfection of all that is. Okay, let's meditate.